So what is this compatibilism idea? How do we define compatibilism? What's going on with compatibilism? Well, it tells us that the Westminster Confession Statement on God's Eternal Decree begins by saying, God from all eternity did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. But, he tells us, then the statement makes this important qualification. Yet so as thereby neither is God the author of sin, nor is violent offered to the will of the creatures, right? Nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established, right? And so he's gonna pursue this a little further, but he doesn't. Our will, violence isn't offered to our will, right? And nor does he take away the liberty and contingency of our particular decisions, right? So he's gonna pursue that here a little further,
right? We will consider the statement about God's being the author of sin in chapter 9, so kick the can a little bit further down the road. But for the moment, let us focus on the last two clauses. Quote, nor is violence offered to the will of the creature, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. So the confession affirms compatibilism. Biblical compatibilism states that God's meticulous sovereignty, that is determinism, he determines, is compatible with human freedom and responsibility. So we're not robots, but we're also not fully free or libertarianly free.
Yeah. And so he says, there's a dual explanation for every choice that human beings make, right? There's two explanations for it, ours and God's. God's sovereign determination serves as the, what he calls, sufficient, primary, ultimate, right? But remote cause of our choices, while we serve as the secondary but proximate, that is the near or immediate cause of our choices. So we have God's is the primary cause, and we're the secondary cause of our choices, right? So he says, while there's some degree of mystery in acknowledging this double agency, right, where we're doing it and God's doing it, dual causation, he says there's nothing contradictory in affirming it. He quotes Paul Helm. He says he brings this out clearly. Paul Helm says the primary cause, God, is an enabling and sustaining cause, making possible secondary causes and setting bounds to them, right? So there we have this dualistic kind of double agency causality that he wants us to understand. So who causes my actions? I do, and God does.
Right. I'm the closer one, but God is also there.
He's the ultimate.
Ultimate, right.
Yeah.
And again, I think we want this to happen with the view of who God is, because if something isn't in his control, then it's apart from God, and it exists independent from God.
And it could be out of his control.
Right.
I mean, if it's not in, it's got to be out of his control. And do we want a world where it's out of God's control?
Right. So, again,
that's not what the scripture
implications
teaches.
To it. And, right, again, what is our ultimate starting point in scripture? Yet, God's causal power is rarely, if ever, directly experienced. You know, we don't hear the voice from heaven saying, choose the pancakes.
Or feel God moving my hand. Right.
Yeah. Most people are unaware that he stands behind the choices they make. In this regard, God fixes providential direction, is never coercive. He never moves people to act against their will. This is in spite of the protestations of those like Paul's interlocutor in Romans 9. Good old Romans 9. We always go back to Romans 9:19, who says, why does God still find fault? For who can resist his will? And exactly, that's the person, that's the reason that chapter 9 of Romans is being written, because there are still questions of well, what about the Jews? Why are they still there?
I thought God made promises to the Jews. Is he not going to keep them? You know, and you know, if that's, and you know, if he caused them then to go astray so that he can give grace or mercy to the Gentiles, then why can we find, how do we find fault with what they do? Right. And, it's God's fault.
And one of the kind of like good word pictures that I like going back to that idea of God being the ultimate author. If I were to ask you like, okay, Tolkien, why does Gandalf help Frodo out? Well, because Tolkien wrote it that way. He helps Frodo because that's how Tolkien wrote. Right, but like, why does Gandalf help Frodo? Well, because Tolkien wrote him that way. Okay, sure, I understand that, but in the context of the story, why does Gandalf help Frodo? Well, because he appreciates the simplistic and complex nature of what the Baggins and the Tooks family that ultimately gives us the Hobbit adventure, and then the desire for Frodo to take the ring to Mount Doom. Okay, but which one is it? Yes.
Yeah, it's right. Both. It's right. Tolkien author, and Gandalf.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's the author and the character he has written. And if Gandalf were to suddenly, for wizards it's probably a bad terminology, but if he were to suddenly turn into a rocket ship and head to Mars, hold on, that I didn't know he could do that. That seems kind of antithetical to who this wizard character is. So you say yes. If this was done, it was done against the character's character.
Yeah, exactly. He's no longer that character.
Right. Right?
Yeah. And so, you know, when the Romans 9:19 in Alakia asks these questions, why does God still find fault if he's in control, right? Who can resist his will? You know, the implication is that God is morally blamable, culpable for people's actions, even their sinful ones. But Christensen tells us, and we find this in James 13, is rather, empathetic, right? He says, James says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one, right? So it's not God's fault, right? He's emphatic on this particular point. He tells us that one of the major implications here is that God does not infuse an evil will into the one who sins. God doesn't kind of put that, you know, infuse that evil will.
Right.
In fact, Satan doesn't coerce people either, right? So God doesn't force us to do it, and neither does Satan. Satan doesn't have the power to force us, right, in terms of unless we're possessed, right, to do anything,
yeah.
Right. So the evil one's temptations are powerful and debilitating, and we find that in 2 Corinthians 4:4. But sinners willfully abide by the desires of the devil, right?
Mm-hmm.
We follow our father, John 8:44,
yeah.
And we do it of our own accord,
yeah.
Right?
We do see kind of the strain a little bit, and it's covered twice, but God sends a spirit to David to count the troops or to do a census, something that he was commanded explicitly not to do as a result of his sin with Bathsheba. And so the desire for David is there. He's not being tempted by God, but God allows temptation to come upon him, and his actions are known of what will happen to God because
In fact, he sends the temptation, right? He sends it.
He's given the three choices there as well. Here it says that God does tempt because he sends the Spirit. Well, again, we talk about primary and secondary causes and God allowing things to happen. And even James 1 talks about when you come upon trials, count them as good because you're being tested. Your faith is being strengthened. You know, it's like working out. You break down muscle to build it up, and you become stronger. So again, when we talk about these things, and we say, oh, you know, this is a issue with Scripture, we again have to read the context and understand the what's being talked about and all these things. And so that tends to be the one where I see people drawing parallels. So, oh, here God's tempting David, but it says God doesn't tempt anyone. Mm-hmm. There's the nuance within there.
Yeah.
So ultimately, the sinful inclinations of the heart instrumentally determine whether temptation is given into.
Right. So notice here I walk by a bar, right? And people there are drinking. That's, I don't drink alcohol. And so I have no problem with walking by. But the person who's an alcoholic walks by the same bar, right? They then are tempted, right? So you know, are we saying then that God sent that temptation? Well, yes and no. He's in control of it, right? But it's the person, right? And so we can have a, you know, we can have a character trait that we are disposed to alcoholism, and so you know we go into the bar and do that.
We could have taken the longer route home and avoided the bar lane, but yeah. No, we happened to just so find ourselves in the neighborhood.
Right. So again, the point is, you know, what's the source of the temptation?
The heart. Yeah.
Right.
We always choose according to the matrix of internal dispositions and external temporal influences, those that exist in time. So we have what's in our nature and character, and then also outside influences is what it's saying. That directs us, those internal and external, that directs us to the path that we are most inclined to take. We always choose what we want most, what we most want to choose, and what we most want to choose corresponds to our strongest motives, desires, and internal inclinations as influenced by a variety of external factors. And again, we can tell ourselves, well, I want to forgo food for this meal.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I want to fast. Well, that's still the desire. That's the ultimate.
What you want right? to
I
do.
Want food, yeah. But my ultimate desire is to forgo food. Yeah. And so those factors that internal, both I want to do this, and external, like, it'll make me more healthy, or, you know, if within the Christian context, we're doing it for a spiritual purpose there. Such as our immediate circumstances, our interpersonal interactions, our upbringings, our education, our the influences of authority figures, the sources of media we consume, and so forth. All those things are factors that influences our decisions, but ultimately what we do is all those things interact and inform what our ultimate desires are.